Folks, this is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett. I'll be joined in a moment by Simon Foster. But if you're on a video version of the show, you can just see him there. He's lying right there. Anyway, folks, this is a big show. Yeah, that's right. I say it's a big show every week. This is actually a big show. We are talking about one of the big movie events of the year, at least culturally-ish for some people. I don't know. We'll talk about that in a bit. It's called Dune Part 2. Not to be mistaken for, actually can't be mistaken for anything. It is the sequel to the TV movie Dune Part 1 that we all saw a couple of years ago during COVID. That's right. It's one of those episodes. I'm going to talk about Shogun, the new, we get it here in Australia on Disney Plus, but it's an FX Hulu show in the US. It is a remake of the 1980s miniseries or a re-adaptation of the book of a similarish name. I don't think that's entirely the right name. But anyway, we're talking about that program. Simon's got a documentary you'll almost never see called Four Daughters. There's a show which maybe you've all seen called This Is Me Now, not to be mistaken with the original version, This Is Me. And I'm also going to take a look at the new HBO drama called The Regime. But is it a comedy? Question mark. We'll find out. Also, we're going to quietly discuss a little thing called the future of cinema by way of a plucky little pig from the UK. Folks, actually, wait, no, let's address this right now. Folks, this week's episode includes the review that Simon Foster did not want you to hear. If that's not sizzle for this podcast, I don't know what is. This is Screen Watching.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher, mother,
secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Look, I said it up front, but this is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Simon Foster, I'm going to trust that you're well, and we're just going to dive right into the, look, it's the sad news of the week. This is the week where we found out that one of the greatest stand-up comedians of all time slash one of the most beloved Curb Your Enthusiasm stars passed away. We are going to talk about the sad news, which has rocked the TV industry this week. We're going to talk about the farewell of Jack McCoy from Law & Order.
Yes. Hello, Dan Barrett. We should mention that you're right. The very sad passing of Richard Lewis, who you referred to there, was kind of a shock, but also the... Now, how does this play out in Law & Order? Does Jack McCoy, well, maybe we shouldn't give it away, does he pass away in the show or does he just resign from the office? This would be a huge spoiler for those of us that enjoyed Law & Order all these years. But yeah, the had a week two to watch. Icons of Hollywood are gone.
People have had a week to watch this, Simon. Like, they've had enough time to catch up on the exit of Jack McCoy from Law & Order. Okay, here's the thing. And for those of you who don't realize that Law & Order is available again in Australia to watch, Binge started streaming about 4 months ago. So, okay, a bit of convoluted background. Law & Order started in 1947. So, yeah, it was timed with the Steven Spielberg name, film of the same name. Movie got released. Sorry, the TV show got released. 5 years later, you had Sam Waterston join the cast. So he wasn't there at the beginning. But he was with that show from 1994, so 5 years in, through to 2010, when the show got cancelled. So they brought the show to an end. The original Law & Order wasn't really rating as well as Law & Order SVU, and there were other TV movements at the time. And it didn't really make sense to keep on going with Law & Order. It was a bit of a middling performer. Certainly, it wasn't quite at the heights it had been throughout the late 90s going into the 2000s. So, like, let's wind down the program. But then, about, like, 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, NBC are like, you know what? Let's just bring back the original Law & Order. So Stan Waterston came back, Anthony Anderson, who was one of the cops on the show at the time, he came back as well, and a few of the other sort of supporting players around the place. So they just brought back the show, and it just continued on. It was as though the show had never really gone away. And the show can do that, because every week it's like a brand new murder mystery. Yeah. So like it did that, and it's come back. But in Australia, we haven't actually had the show. I haven't been screening it. So Binge picked it up.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so they did the, like, two seasons that we hadn't seen in Australia. And then in this third season, something really interesting happened, which caught my attention. So I started watching it. Okay. And it was that, and right now as we're doing this, I've just suddenly forgotten the actor's name, and it's outrageous because ordinarily I just tell you the actor's name and it wouldn't be an issue in my brain, but I'm struggling right now. I can't even think of his character.
I've got to admit, I haven't gone. I must admit, I was a huge Law and Order fan and remained a huge Law and Order fan all these years. I think back to the, for me, which peak Law and Order, the Angie Harmon, the Benjamin Bratt, the Elizabeth Rome years, of course, the great Jerry Orbach in there, God rest his soul. But it was quality television. It had got a bit chintzy in the last couple of years. I remember seeing some of the episodes, but it's yeah, to see Jack McCoy move on is end of a TV era, that's for sure.
Oh, we were getting there. So I was just going to say, Reed Scott is the guy I was trying to think of. He's the guy that played Dan Egan in Veep. I know him best probably from My Boys. People may have seen him in the last year as part of the cast for the final season of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I think that he's just a really good TV screen presence just generally. But he joined the cast of Law & Order. And I was like, okay, I wouldn't mind seeing him sort of in the program. And I started watching the first few episodes. I'm like, yeah, I'm really enjoying this. And I've never been a big Law & Order viewer. I've seen scattered episodes here and there. Hasn't really been part of my TV diet. But anyway, he's on it. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm going to watch this. No, I don't really like any of these programs, to be completely honest. Like, they're perfectly competent.
The SVU sort of brand has become a little bit silly and kind of cheesy over the last few years and hasn't really worked a treat at all. But Law & Order seems to have maintained its integrity and flowed on, improved with age, some might say. And Sam Waterston, I mean, he's an actor. God, I remember all the way back to The Killing Fields back in 83. Prior to that, he was in Heaven's Gate, one of my all-time favorite movies, the great flopperoo of all time. So he's one of the most respected actors, character actors in Hollywood. He's worked alongside the likes of Woody Allen and, you know, some amazing people in his career. So that he has had to have him have been awarded this amazing character to have played all this time is just wonderful. I'm so excited for God bless you, Sam Waterston, and you too, Jack McCoy.
Yeah, so just to actually provide some continuity to what I was saying to where Simon just wanted to drop in talking points, just a week or two after I started watching this, they announced that Sam Waterston was leaving. And they didn't do it at the end of the last season. They didn't do it to, like, mark the beginning of the season. They just did it, like, five episodes into the series run, which happened last week, and we got the episode, you know, within a few hours of the US. What I thought was kind of interesting was that there was, as I was watching these five episodes and watching Sam Waterston's place within it, he is a man who's 83 years old. The fact that he came back for the revival at all, I think, was more a favor to the show's production than it was that he felt that he really wanted to keep on playing Jack McCoy. So I think it's kind of telling that 2 years in, he's dropping out. But you watch those five episodes and he is not in it very much. It was basically one scene per episode coming through. And then suddenly in this fifth episode, there's a bit of the storyline's about a tech guy that ends up murdering a woman in Central Park. But the guy has a friendship with the son of the city mayor. And so it becomes a little bit of a political hot topic as to the decision to bring the mayor's son into it. He's had an extramarital affair. And so that gets revealed on the stand. So, you know, he's very much not won any favors by putting this kid up on the stand. Jack McCoy, he supports the decision, but he more or less sort of falls on his sword because somebody has to take it for the team. So anyway, basically, and so he has like his sort of big sort of dramatic moment where he has to leave the scene. And what I thought was good about the episode is it gave him some real sort of a reason of integrity to leave, but also a unexpected reason to leave as well that wasn't being blown up in a car somewhere or some sort of health issue or whatever. It was very much core to what this character's been about since 1994.
Those exploding cars in New York. What was the big miniseries last year that Sam Waterston was in? I want to say Dope Sick, or maybe I want to say the Amanda Seyfried one, and he played a prime role in that. All right, you know, that intro just blew way out of proportion. We really should talk reviews now.
Indeed. Play the clip. Shall we go with June first, or? You want to go with
I said
first?
I want to do Four Daughters first, just because I want to push through that. So,
yeah, cool.
Got a bit to say. Well, not a bit to say. All right, Daniel okay, Barrett, we're back here for the review sec. No, sorry.
Can I just do you the intro?
Sure.
It stinks.
There's one big title this week that absolutely needs to be discussed. Simon, are we talking Four Daughters?
We are talking Four Daughters, my friend. Let's have a clip.
في الفيلم هذا باش نحاول نحكي حكاية بنت ألفا. ألفا عندها أربع بنات.
هذيك المصيبة، لا أني من نكره الطفلة وكنت ما نحبش ما حبيتش نجيب حتى الطفلة.
So to put all of that in context, this is the story of a family, a Tunisian family, and specifically the matriarch of that family, a woman named Alpha, who has four daughters, the four daughters of the title, two of which, the two eldest daughters, have gone the way of ISIS when the Tunisian regime went very conservative and went very hard line several years ago. These two elderly daughters were whisked away by their man friends at the time, and were radicalized and joined up with ISIS. The two younger daughters, who are central to this documentary, Aya and Tasia, recount the moment when all this happened and also recount the wonderful and at times challenging life they had as four young women, five with the mother, growing up in Tunisia, which is a very patriarchal, a toxically patriarchal society in many regards. What is especially special, I guess you could say, about this documentary is that it uses actresses to play the two older sisters in their absence. The two actresses, Ikrak Matir and Nawa Karui, are called into reenact moments in the family's life that were particularly devastating, particularly happy at times, but which reveal a family life that was sort of based on a whole lot of clashes, clashes with society, clashes with the mother, clashes between the two sisters, but ultimately a sort of a unity in sisterhood and a bond in you know, family life that was quite profound. Add on top of that the fact that the actresses get to play themselves as well and comment on the emotions that they've got to act. And you've got this incredibly meta, multi-layered documentary, which last week, a few days ago as we record this, won the Independent Spirit Award for Best Documentary, is Oscar nominated for Best Documentary, is coming to Australia in a from a new production outfit that's been set up just for this film and is going into a handful of cinemas. But to see something that's totally unique and totally challenges the genre of which it's a part of so determinedly, and to create a story and a vision of this family who are put upon from all different angles and have to deal with abuse within the walls of the house, abuse as they walk the streets, the rise of ISIS and the impact it had on both the women and the greater society of Tunisia at the time. You have this extraordinary documentary that plays big and expansive and vast with its themes, but is very intimate and very sad and very moving when it's got to do with the four daughters of the title. So I just wanted to mention that straight out of the bat, because in a week of really big reviews we're doing and big releases, Four Daughters shouldn't get hidden away. It's one of the best things I've seen in a long, long time.
Yeah. Simon, the big title that I'm excited to talk about this week is Shogun.
Hear me, my son. I alone will tell you the truth. Death. The only punishment here.
I have not told you my family name, but it is well known in Japan.
Every year, Simon, there's a couple of TV titles that have a lot of anticipation around them, a lot of just general buzz that everyone's really excited to check out. And invariably, when it comes to the end of the year, when people are putting together their top 10 lists, almost certainly those shows never crop up as being one of the shows of the year. Like, they always manage to disappoint in some way and never really quite live up to it. I kind of think that Shogun lives up to the expectation on it. Now, this is based on a book and a mini-series, and let's be real, it's based more on a mini-series than it is the book. So this is a mini-series that came out in, I think it's September 1980. I was all of 3 or 4 months old when this was originally on TV. I've never seen this mini-series. I had Richard Chamberlain in it, and my understanding of it, Simon, I'm assuming that you've seen it, as you got a little bit more
peak peak miniseries viewing. And in fact, the James Clavell book was also a huge part of my growing up, and had a prominent place on my parents' bookshelf. So I remember the word shogun, the shogun, being front and center. Yeah, and the miniseries was right at the peak of the miniseries boom in the early 80s there. So, yeah, I remember this very well.
Yeah, so I think there was a lot of sort of cultural heat around it. My understanding, though, of the miniseries and possibly the book as well, is it's a little bit sort of white saviorish. In terms of the way it approached the story. So I kind of had that
one
in mind.
One of the complaints about it, for sure.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, this is one of these big shows of the year. This is highly anticipated. Like, can they really get away with a white savior story? And, like, that's certainly, I don't think the story's changed, but certainly the perspectives on the story have changed a little bit. And, again, this is coming from having not read the book or the miniseries. So excuse me if I'm making some assumptions here or going down a path that I don't think is quite right. But what I think is kind of interesting about the general setup to this, and sorry, just to explain what's actually going on in this, basically there's a bit of a mounting power struggle in terms of who's going to be looking after Japan. And so as the it's like five very sort of heads of family are all sort of about to take part in their Game of Thrones style, like succession games to work out who's going to be, you know, leading the place, this boat rocks up. And so on this boat comes out a British guy named John Blackthorne, played by the fantastically named Cosmo Jarvis. Anyway, he steps out, and I don't know Cosmo Jarvis from anything, but he just seems generally familiar in a way that sometimes these actors do. But anyway, this guy steps out, and immediately the Japanese imprison him and whatnot. But what's taking place, and this is what ties into what's different about this miniseries and why I think the original miniseries really sort of popped, I guess, at the in the mid to late 70s. Oh, sorry, early 80s, rather. Is a couple of things. So this guy, he's brought into Japan. It's in 1600, and it's at a time where Japan has had some experiences with the Portuguese. Okay, and so anytime in the show that you're watching people speaking in English, in the show they're not actually speaking English, they're speaking Portuguese. And so that's an important note to sort of take on board. So even this British guy is speaking Portuguese. The reason he's doing that is because the world had at that point been largely split up by two dominating Anglo forces. So you had the Portuguese, who decided to carve the world in half and take one side of it, and then the Spanish took the other half. Meanwhile, the British are like, hey, we don't really like these trade routes, and we all know how history works, and the Brits tend to, you know, find their way up there over the next couple of centuries. But in Japan at the time, the only real experience they had with the Portuguese, and it's clearly a bit of a fractious relationship, but one which they're finding their way into at the time. When this guy, Jack Blackthorne, turns up, he's providing an entirely different viewpoint, a different experience. He's not coming in there necessarily as a white savior, or at least not as evident from these first two episodes. Instead, he's actually coming in there kind of almost as a vein of information. So within this, there's this really great scene that's probably the scene that really got me, like, on board with this program. Because up until then, it was that standard sort of Game of Thrones thing. Well, it's that standard Game of Thrones thing where there's lots of people having conversations about their political setup. And it's like, well, I don't really understand the political dynamics here. So it's a little bit alienating. But there's just this great sequence where they sit down and he just explains, this is my perspective on the world. This is where I'm seeing everything coming from. And we're also seeing it from the perspective of the Japanese looking at this going, what are these white people doing to us? Like, they think that they own the world. We own Japan. This is our country. And so you actually get these two viewpoints coming through, which makes it really compelling viewing.
Great.
So that's how they... Yeah, that's how they break away from the white savior aspect. He's not a savior coming to save them. Rather, he's coming to the people with a sense of information. Now, what I think is really interesting about that is I kind of feel that the original miniseries that this is based on, and possibly the book to a certain extent as well, almost served as the same function to bring Japan to Western countries back in the day. So there was a period of the 70s where Japanese culture started becoming really, really big. Okay, you had the kung fu movies, obviously. You've got things like teriyaki sauce, which I don't know if you know much about teriyaki sauce, Simon, but next time you're tucking into a delicious bowl of teriyaki, Well, just know that the food dish that you're eating isn't really Japanese as much as it's from Seattle. And so it was a Japanese immigrant in the area who brought teriyaki sauce there and turned it into kind of what we know as a teriyaki chicken or beef dish today. It's the way that culture works. And like, it's fun. This is what always annoys me about the idea of appropriation. It's the thing is that a lot of the fun things and a lot of the entry points we have into culture often come through mild points of appropriation. And you go to Japan and they appropriate Western culture everywhere. And it's fun. And it's really just engaging. I love seeing the way that Japan plays around with Western motifs and characters and brands. And it's great. I really enjoy it. But Shogun, originally as a miniseries, I think that was kind of serving the same function that Jack Blackthorne has in this series, which is it was kind of providing some context and some understanding as to what was happening in Japan and the history of Japan and how it can actually be integrated into more of a global sort of a context. So I think that was happening. It sort of legitimized things. And as I was doing some reading up about the original miniseries, like this current version, it was a Japanese-American co-production, but in Japan, nobody watched it. They did not care about this series at all. It's iconically one of the big miniseries, as you mentioned, of American television. But in Japan, it just kind of came and went. And the reason for that is that big, sweeping historical dramas like this are already just a fixture on Japanese TV. They don't need to see their history as seen through the eyes of white Americans, because every year they've got, and I meant to save the name of this and I've sort of mixed it up, but there's a genre of television and I don't know if it's a genre, but it's definitely a type of television that airs every year in Japan. Sure. It runs on, I think, NRK. And so for about 40 to 45 weeks of the year, they run these big sweeping historical dramas, and they're from different time points and whatnot. Sometimes they're more contemporary during the Olympics year.
Feudal Japan 3 years ago. And samurais and all that sort of stuff. That's exactly right.
Sometimes it's about like Olympians or whatever. Like, it's kind of a bit different, but there have been a lot of these sort of feudal Japan types of things. And so you look at this thinking, well, it's understandable why they didn't really sort of care about this. And I don't know that they're going to care about Shogun, the American-Japanese co-production. But we're not in Japan. We don't really have these sweeping epics all that often. I watched this. I was swept. I am very into this program. We had a conversation on this podcast last week, week before. Not sure. It all blends together because the magic, who can separate it? But we had this conversation about my belief that I don't really want to review programs anymore beyond what's available for that first week of consumption. Okay, first week of consumption for Shogun, we get episodes 1 and 2 back to back. To me, if you're not sold by the end of that second episode, then you're probably not going to come back for week 3 or week 4. And so that's kind of how like basing my reviews. I watched episodes 1 or 2, which are streaming now on Disney Plus here in Australia, or as I mentioned earlier, on Hulu in the US. And I think that if you watch this as just episode 1, I don't know you're necessarily going to get hooked into this. But by the end of episode 2, I think that they do open up the world to the point where they're actually explaining it more to the audience. And while episode 1, you kind of swept away a little bit by some of the gorgeous production design on it, by the end of episode 2, these are real characters that all have interesting perspectives and agendas. And I am down for this. I want to watch this week to week and really just sort of revel with this as everyone is, I think, going to get a lot more excited about it. This week, there's not a lot of buzz around the program. There's a little bit of buzz, like it's sort of percolating away in the background, but I do think this is going to be a shower and a grower over the next, I'd say probably months. I can, by the end of the first season, people are going to be very into this and ready for season 2 when it debuts next year.
I'll weigh in very quickly on it. I also watched the first 2 episodes. As we've established, I was probably a little bit more aware of the impact of the miniseries and the book when it first came out. This new version of Shogun definitely gives a more even perspective in terms of the British characters, the John Blackthorne character and his impact on 1600s, what's that, 15th century, 17th century Japan. The original miniseries was very much a starring Richard Chamberlain kind of deal. In this one, Cosmo Jarvis, best name ever, has a more balanced role in the show alongside all these wonderful Japanese actors. To highlight amongst them, Anno Sui, I think it's pronounced, who's the lead from the Monarch Godzilla show on Apple TV, who I'm just so excited to see back on television. I'm a big, huge fan of hers. They have some wonderful scenes together. This, you're right, this does move forward in fairly small increments, although what is being dealt with in the story is a turning point in Japanese history and its interaction with Western cultures as the Portuguese and the Spanish and the British move into sort of Eastern Asian parts of the world. The scene you point out when he's drawing in the sand what the rest of the world or his part of the world thinks of Japan and how they now own it, the dawning realization on the face of the gathered Japanese lords and his host in particular is just really powerful stuff. It's one of the best scenes I've seen in a long time. I disagree a little bit that the first episode won't hook you in. I thought it set up the characters and set up the drama beautifully. Features that horrible moment when one of the pirates is put to death in a manner that is graphically staged and horrible to watch, but has also some of the most spectacular scenery and spectacular staging you'll see on television in a long time. So, yes, I was hooked straight away with this Disney Plus Hulu series. And, yeah, I'm locked in for the next 10-episode arc. I think it's a 10-episode.
Yeah, it's 10 episodes. I don't know if you saw my newsletter this morning, but do you realize where this is filmed?
I did read the newsletter this morning, yes. You should lead off with that because you did the homework, but I was surprised. I mean, I wasn't surprised because that's the nature of international productions, but to learn that it was Vancouver, everyone, there you go, I blew it, was, I mean, that's just the majesty of what Hollywood can do now and Japan.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, there's not going to be any location shooting because it's 1600 era Japan. It's not going to look the same. Like, it's, you know. There's suddenly plenty of old buildings.
Travel, Dan. They're just hiding it from us.
But yeah, for an American-Japanese co-production, it just sort of amused me a little bit. It was being filmed in Vancouver, like every other American show ever has been.
All right. Time for us to move on to a film that was also shot in parts of Vancouver, Dune Part 2.
It's okay. I'm here. While since you've had one of those nightmares, tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear.
May not have been shot in Vancouver. Dune Part 2 hits cinemas, sequel to one of the biggest TV movies of all time, Dune. There you go. I got in early before you could. You know, I'm joking. I hate it when you say that. Dune Part 2 picks up almost, well, definitely exactly where the last film finished. Paul Atreides, played by Timothée Chalamet, is becoming ensconced in the Fremen way of life, learning from Javier Bardem and Zendaya and all these wonderful actors with blue eyes and things stuck up their noses, the way of the Fremen so that he can become the Kwisatz Haderach, the great prophet who will rise up with the Fremen and help the Fremen take back their rightful planetary possessions. It's a big, huge, sweeping film that I have read some complaints about is too long. For me, it wasn't. I will state that the opening bit where we get to watch Zendaya and Timothée fall in love and sort of become more ensconced in the Fremen lore and the Fremen way of life may seem a bit drawn out to some. To me, it wasn't. I kind of really got into it, and those opening that opening sort of 45 minutes helped me understand the scale of what Paul Atreides was going to achieve and why it was so important. He was the prophet and why it was crucial to the planet's existence that he became totally familiar with life as a Fremen guiding light, I guess you could say. So for me, this was probably better than I expected it to be, because I know from the being a big fan of the David Lynch version of Dune, and that's a sentence that isn't spoken very often, I kind of knew where this film was going, and I guess I was fortunate that I was able to pick up. So when Lea Seydoux turns up as a small character, or when Austin Butler's finally introduced as the villainous bald-headed black and white character. I kind of knew where they fit into the greater narrative of Dune, so I was lucky in that regard. But I still think there's so much in here to take away as not only a great bit of science fiction, but a great bit of storytelling as well. It's got a very, I was convinced of its mythical elements, let's just say. It was believable in a way that, in the same kind of way that Peter Jackson made Lord of the Rings accessible for a much more vast audience, I think Denis Villeneuve has done the same thing with Dune Part 2. What were your thoughts? Yeah. I'm not quite sure what your thoughts were. I know you saw it.
Look, I found this as a film of sort of mixed pleasures. I agree with you entirely in terms of what you were saying, that it's an accessible movie, and I think this is actually a far more accessible film than the first one was. The first one I found sort of fairly distancing in parts, but like once the film really sort of got rolling, like it was, you know, certainly very enjoyable, but, you know, it took about an hour and a half to get there and for me to really understand exactly what I was watching and sort of being fully into it. In this one, I kind of felt like I was absorbed into it more from just the get-go, from jump. And in part, obviously, that's because I'd seen the first film, but also I think the challenge for this one is I hadn't seen that first film for, what, like 2-3 years now since the first one came out, and I didn't actually really remember all that much about it. So there was definitely that sort of learning curve at the beginning, trying to remember, oh, who's that character again, and who's that? Oh, that's his mum. And then just, you know, trying to do that catch up in my brain as to everything that was going on. So like I had that sort of aspect. So like that kind of distanced me out for like the first 10-15 minutes. But after that, I was kind of into it. I think in terms of spectacle, I think this works like remarkably well. I did find, and it was interesting watching Shogun up against this, where if you watch Dune 2, I think that we've seen so many sort of high scale, broad spectacles on a big screen, particularly films set in distant off-world planets on like sand planets, that there wasn't really much that was being done visually in this that sort of awed me. The overall sensation, the overall filmmaking obviously sort of caught me up, but it did kind of feel as though there wasn't really anything that was just visually knocking my socks off. Whereas I was watching Shogun just thinking, well, they're doing this on a TV budget, and just sort of seeing everything that they were achieving on screen there kind of did sort of shock me a little bit. So like that was kind of just interesting, these two scales of perspective sitting into it. As blockbuster storytelling goes, like, you know, Dune 2 kind of delivers it all. The problem that I had with the film, and I couldn't really quite shake it, was that obviously it's an adaptation of a book loosely. It's an adaptation of several books, kind of grabbing what you can and sort of shoving it in there, and then also massaging that into a way that's going to make sense to an audience that aren't sort of, you know, knee deep in the lore that's been created around like this world. It kind of felt as though there was a little bit of going through the motions a bit. So it was one, knowing that, oh, I've got to hit this sort of story beat so that this story beat can happen. And it didn't really feel like there was any sort of texture or padding or emotional sort of connection that you had to these moments. Case in point being there's a sequence where the mother has told this other lady, hey, look, a dude's going to turn up to drink this, and men aren't supposed to drink this mysterious liquid that they get from the insides of the large, or the smaller worms, but, you know, the worms that live on this planet. So basically, you can wrench out one of these worms, get some blue liquid out of it, and get going with your day. Only women can drink that. Men can't handle it. But she says to the lady, hey, look, a guy's going to turn up. He's going to want to drink it. Let him drink it. And she's like, oh, I can't believe you're saying this. This is crazy to me. And then you kind of think, well, obviously by the end of the movie, some guy's going to turn up and drink it. And you're like, is it going to be, you know, the bad guy? Is it going to be our hero, Paul Atreides? And you sort of think about it for a minute or two. And before you can really sort of get invested in the mystery aspect of that too much, that very J.J. Abrams mystery box kind of concept of, you know, let's throw this out there and build the entire story around it, suddenly Paul Atreides just rocks up and drinks it. And it's like, well, why set this up as a mystery when you're just going to resolve it like 5 minutes later? Like, little things like that just sort of seemed a little bit strange. Like, she needed to be able to do that because there's an element of telling prophecies in the story and knowing what's to come, okay, or at least having a loose idea of what's to come, okay? So she has to set up a mystery around it, but then the film itself doesn't actually commit itself to that as a mystery. Instead, it just kind of uses it as a plot point to get to that. And I definitely felt that in the back end of this movie, the back half, there was just a lot of that sort of maneuvering around. It was more chess piece moves than it was actual real need for story engagements. So I just struggled with that a little bit, but largely I was like, I had a fun time with it. It's just that I sort of looked at that thing. It's not quite as satisfying as I maybe wish that it was because of that.
I think I took away, like, I found some real emotion in the story, and I found certainly the point where, and if you really desperately don't want spoilers, and maybe don't listen to this, but I mean, we kind of know the story of June. The moment where Paul gives Simon, his speech to the gathered Fremen.
Words, everyone knows what this story is. They don't need, it's fine.
The when Paul gives his big speech to the room full of Fremen, and he rises up and is sort of, and people like Javier Bardem, and to a certain but lesser extent Zendaya, and she gets the final scene in this movie, so you got some idea that what might happen in a part three, and this is as big a hit as people will say it's going to be. I thought that was a really emotional sequence, and I thought it sort of got to the heart of what it meant to him, of his journey to become this prophet and to represent the Fremen people. Although there are some divisions within the Fremen that think that an outsider like him is not the person that should be doing that. So there's complexity here, and there's real human and or alien emotion, and there's certainly spectacle. So, yeah, I thought it delivered exactly as it should have delivered. Dune Part 2 through Warners is in cinemas everywhere. I think that gets us to our much-vaunted intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Welcome back. Yes, it's time for intermission, that part of the show that everybody really digs. And I'm calling this one Peppa Pig and the Future of Cinema. Now, let me put that in some sort of context. Dan chose to introduce little Murphy, little beautiful Murphy, to cinema by way of the big screen sing-along episode compile, Peppa Pig's Cinema Party, not, as I suggested, Fellini's Armacord. But what happened was that this daddy-daughter day out soon pivoted into some kind of journey of revelation, not for Murphy, who was alternatively delighted and distracted by the trip to the movies, but for one Daniel Barrett, who pitched this segment to be as being relevant to the future of cinema. His words, ladies and gentlemen, his words. We had a very heated back and forth by text during the week in which I said, you're not going to talk about Peppa Friggin' Pig in my podcast. And you said, I've got something very interesting to say with regard to my journey to see Peppa Pig Cinema Party. So, Daniel Barrett, enlighten us as to what this pig did for you.
I mean, there's a question. Do you want the G-rated version or the X-rated version? Because, boy, Simon, I got some stories.
Tell me the X-rated one off air.
Okay. You see, when a man loves a pig very much... No, Simon, okay. Here's what needs to be understood about this. People right now are thinking, yes, oh, Dan's going to talk about Peppa Pig for a while, and I'm not really. Peppa Pig's kind of just like an entry point into some broader conversations about sort of cinema-type stuff. I referred to it as the future of cinema just to annoy Simon a bit by text message, and he took things a bit far. The thing to keep in mind as well is that I said, I'm going to talk about Peppa Pig. And Simon said, by Jove, you're not. And I said, oh, no, I'm going to talk about Peppa Pig. And Simon's like, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. Or
not in my podcast. Not in my podcast was my exact words.
Okay. So anyway, Simon talked about all that. And then he went and watched the Peppa Pig movie. And nobody told him to go and watch Peppa Pig Cinema Party.
No.
I went for it, but no. I kind of had to. Simon didn't have to, so I just like to establish that Simon went above and beyond to go and see this movie for no apparent reason, but that's neither here nor there.
First of all, I was told really by the center management when I said I wanted one ticket to see Peppa Pig Cinema Party, and I had to explain first of all to her and then to an elderly lady who was there with her grandchild in the cinema that I was doing it for a podcast and we'd be discussing some kind of alternative content in cinema thing, and I'm here so I'm able to contribute. So I saw it. My review is that it's not very good for a property that's been around for 20 years and has made billions of dollars. They could have paid for some better kid actors. It was kind of crap. But let's hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I think it's probably important that people know that Simon has the same outfit he wears every time he goes to see a movie, which is a very traditional trench coat. So I don't know where that really factors into your experience at the multiplex. Yeah, so look, this is what the movie is. So it's called Peppa Pig's Cinema Party. Now, I'll admit I didn't really know anything about the movie other than I knew that it was a thing that was playing, and I'd seen some promotions saying that it starred Katy Perry. And I was like, yeah, sure, okay. So I kind of figured that at the end of the movie, we'd see some animated pig action with some real-life Katy Perry sort of mixed into it all. That's not the case at all. She voiced one of the characters in the opening three-part storyline against Orlando Bloom, who didn't make the marketing, so make of that what you will. Basically, what this is, there's a very popular kids cartoon called Peppa Pig, Mr. Raccoon, and she was Mrs. something or other. Mrs. Leopard, I think. Anyway, yes, it really does not matter. But yeah, Peppa Pig, it's a kids cartoon from the UK. And I'm just going to assume that most people listening haven't really got a lot of Peppa Pig experience, because unless you got a small kid in the house, like, why would you? Like, I don't really know Peppa Pig until the last, you know, year or so. So you got Peppa Pig. The way that these cartoons work and the way that all cartoons really function these days for the preschool set is that they run for a duration of usually about 6 or 7 minutes. Some of these shows will be sort of packaged in blocks where you might get a 15-minute show, which is two of these 7-minute installments back to back. But generally, they get played as 7 minutes. This is particularly good if you're watching, say, on ABC iView on ABC Kids. And the way that the linear feed works is that every 7 minutes you get like a new cartoon coming through. Perfect for little ones where they're probably only watching for about an hour, because you don't really want have kids watching for that long, ultimately, if you're responsible or responsible adjacent, as I am. So, you know, you watch that and kids don't have long attention spans. They can kind of watch that, really enjoy it. Sometimes they get a treat of another episode straight afterwards, but usually about 7 minutes is kind of where their brains are at for it. So I saw that there was this Peppa Pig movie playing, and what the Peppa Pig movie is, as I came to learn before I went and saw it, it's only about 66 minutes long, and you've got an opening section where there's some real-life kids being told, hey, it's Peppa Pig's birthday party, let's go to a party. And so they all go to this party, but I don't remember the party actually ever being seen on the screen. It just takes place for about a minute with all these kids going to see Peppa Pig. So it's really, you know, it's pretty chintzy, to use a phrase that Simon drops pretty regularly on a podcast. So you've got that, and then they go to a three-part storyline where some characters who may be regular Peppa Pig supporting cast members, maybe it's Orlando Bloom and Katy Perry, I'm not really entirely sure. But it's a three-part storyline, but these characters that aren't like core Peppa Pig characters are getting married. So Peppa learns about getting a wedding cake and about getting the bridesmaid's outfit and that sort of thing. They go and get a dress.
In what is a flagrantly heteronormative wedding ceremony. And might I just point out that this Peppa Pig series owes an awful lot to the books of Richard Scarry as well. There's a lot of Richard Scarry in there for those of my generation who grew up with those wonderful books. But I digress. Do go on.
Yeah. Sure. What even is a Richard Scarry? Dick Scarry, don't even know the guy. So you've got this three-part storyline, and then the rest of it is, I think it's like another collection of six shorts that are taken from the upcoming season of Peppa Pig that's coming. And then there was a final animated sort of hybrid thing where they go on a party bus for like a trip somewhere. If you ask me what the storylines were, I know there was one where the dad was performing magic for the kids, and there's another one where they go caravanning, but beyond that, I don't remember the rest of the cartoons. But the way these things function is that they're not for the likes of Simon Foster by himself going along to the cinema. They are for experiences like what I had, which is that I've got a 2.5-year-old little monster who lives in the house. And I was thinking, hey, I would like to take her to a movie, but she doesn't have the attention span for a movie. So you take them along to something like this, and they get to have a bit of a cinema experience. It gets every weekend, it's a challenge to work out, what am I going to do with the kid this weekend? Because you want to take them out in the world and get them to have experiences and, you know, do stuff. So, like, this is kind of a really great way to get kids out for, you know, it goes for an hour, but you spend a bit of time at the shopping center beforehand, a little bit of time afterwards, there's commuting time. It's like a full morning before you go home and have your afternoon nap, and then you wake up and you got, like, another adventure. every weekend of mine is separated into four quarters, Simon. It's four quarters. That was my morning. Yeah. No, I mean, you've been there. You know how
it's future of cinema. We're getting towards the point of the intermission here eventually.
The point of the intermission was never that's the future of cinema. It was just something bullshit that I said during a text exchange with you. But what it speaks to is the current status of cinema and does lean into a little bit where cinema is going, which is that an experience like this, where I took a 2.5-year-old into it, I went and did it with a very specific purpose. We went and saw some TV programming that was there, and it was, we use the phrase on the podcast every so often, a programmer. It's just something that sort of dropped in there to drive a bit of box office attention. It's never going to be the thing that leads the box office in any given week, but it's the thing that isn't the main movie that, you know, people don't necessarily always want to see Dune 2, maybe want to go and see the rom-com that's playing or whatever. There's fewer of those programmers that really get played in cinemas these days, but I'd say that the role of the programmer is actually things like this Peppa Pig TV movie that's being played. If you go to the cinema these days, you'll find the following types of things. There's things like this kids program, which I don't think there's enough of them. So I've had my kid at an age where I could probably have taken her to something like this over the last like 5 months. But there hasn't really been anything playing, which kind of made sense. That only went for an hour because I didn't think she was going to make the hour. I thought she was tapping out after like 20 minutes. Okay, but she made the hour. Like literally, she turned around and said, "Dad, I want to go home now." 3 seconds before the show finished. Okay, which I thought was pretty good. Like she actually almost made it right to the end. Okay, but
that's
like
what Fiona said to me halfway through June.
Yeah, look, I get that. But yeah, so like it's made purely for someone to take a little 2-year-old along to or a 3-year-old, and that's probably about where you start tapping out on Peppa Pig, I would imagine. Maybe Peppa Pig is a, you know, 4 or 5-year-old thing. I don't think so, though. I think it's a bit younger. So it's programs like that. In the US at the moment, they've driven some like sizable box office with The Chosen, which is a TV series about Jesus. It's like a... They keep on talking about it as being like an HBO level of production. It's not quite there, but like it's kind of in that ballpark. Like it's sort of lower tier Showtime FX sort of level production. But this has been a thing which has been slowly building an audience over the last two seasons. It's been running a few years at this point. Mm. But what they do is they produce these fairly expensive shows, distributing them online for free. You can go to thechosen.tv and watch the show for free. But their business model is that they sell merchandise. They then license TV shows to networks around the world who have been buying around it. Like there's a business model for it. Okay. But one of the things I've incorporated to their business model at the moment is cinema releases. So in the US, the upcoming season, which debuts in June, they've been playing across 6 weeks. Every 2 weeks, they're releasing 3 episodes into the cinema. So you go and watch the 3 episodes back to back, and then 2 weeks later, come back for the next set of episodes. I think that's kind of a really interesting sort of business model. So you've got that playing. But then there's the other thing we actually have seen really heavily in cinemas the last couple of years, which is opera. It's stage shows being sort of played in cinemas. Like there's all these things.
Alternative content, it's called in the industry.
Yeah. So when I'm thinking about the future of cinema, and I don't think there's necessarily as much of a place for programmers, as we used to say, but this alternative programming, I think, is the modern day programmer, and it's going to become more and more important to fill these dead spots of the cinema. So the other thing that's happening in the world at the moment is rent is getting really, really expensive, okay? Everyone's noticed this because people either rent homes or they've got a house which they're paying off a ridiculous mortgage on because interest rates are crazy sky high right now or whatever. Same things apply in rental spaces as well. And it's going to become more and more expensive for your Birch Cowan Coil or events or, you know, your Hoyts's, whatever, to rent these spaces out as part of shopping centers. They're needed because they create an anchor and is, you know, business things that I think most people understand about this. But cinemas, it's going to be more and more important for them to be able to fill these dead slots, which is Saturday mornings when usually nobody's really there for them, weekend afternoons when usually that's when those opera things play. I think you're going to find just more and more cinemas looking for these opportunities coming through, which is why I mentioned the phrase future of cinema. But what I actually want to talk to you about, Simon, was this was the entire point of me wanting to talk to you about Peppa Pig.
Yeah.
Like, this is what my entire conversation was.
Can I just make a point quickly? Before you get to your entire point of the conversation, let me just respond to that very quickly. Alternative content has been around for quite some time, and specialist programming is another term for it. Anybody who is throwing themselves back on their bed full of covered in money is attached to the Andre Rieu experience. They turn up two or three times a year, live from Hamburg, live from Copenhagen. That's kind of what we're talking about here. It's that sort of one or two off. And there's been, you know, Led Zeppelin at Budokan, and there's been, you know, these musical ones. Or there's the National Theatre thing, which is on at the moment with Mr. All of Us Strangers doing Hamlet or something, and they're, you know, they're always around. So yeah, this alternative content, you're absolutely right. It is a thing, and I would not be surprised if what you're maybe suggesting, that every now and then on a Saturday morning they put the five best episodes of Game of Thrones or a Jack McCoy marathon of something for Law and Order fans into cinemas on a Saturday morning. So yeah, I get it. I know what you're saying. I'm not against that at all. And they've been doing it with sporting events too, State of Origin and World Cup stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that if you go to like some more boutique cinemas at the moment, so if I went up to the Angelica up the road, every Tuesday they now play classic movies, and like that's a regular thing you see at some more art house cinemas around the place. Like, just the elements to bring people to the cinema that isn't whatever the big release is of the week is just becoming more and more prevalent. And I think it's just going to become more of an integral part of that cinema experience going forward as they're trying to, you know, find ways to plug holes, especially at the moment. So you've got that. But what I want to talk about was... Well, this is the whole point of it, Simon. You derailed me with this whole future of television. You're like, I'll do the intro. And I'm like, you don't even know what the segment's about. The segment is about this. Okay. So as I went to the cinema with a 2.5-year-old, just like a lot of things in life that I'm experiencing over the last sort of 2.5 years has been seeing the world and my own life experience through new eyes. So one, it was fun going to a cinema and seeing a cinema for the first time through some new eyes. Okay, like she's never been to a cinema before. She saw it in an episode of Bluey once, and that's kind of her only real sort of experience with it. So she went in, and like you'd see, she was like a bit interested in like the bigness of it all. She was excited by the Daytona video game machine out in the foyer, the many machines that have skill testing type elements involved. Skill testing. You've got all of that sort of thing. When she actually went into the auditorium, I've got a photo of her walking in, and like she's a bit sort of overawed by it. Like that was all fun stuff. It was fun seeing what she was interested in as her attention was wavering from the movie a bit, which was in the aisles. You've got those lights that usually are there to show people how they can get to their seats. Okay. Or you've also got the lights that sort of sit behind a plastic thing that has the number of the row and the seats that are there.
Yep.
Okay. She's excited by those. Arm went down the side. She started playing with that. That fell off. I didn't realize they could be pulled off, but I discovered this on that Saturday morning. I got a daddy fix it. So I had to go and fix that up. Oh, like that sort of thing was fun. But one of the other things I interrogated was this Peppa Pig special. It's like a whole bunch of episodes from the TV show with some interstitial stuff that's been created for the special. This sort of thing isn't new either. I was watching this sort of stuff as a kid myself. Probably the greatest example of one of these things existing is a film that I'm sure you've seen, Simon. I'm sure everybody listening to us has watched, the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie. Okay, this is a film that comes out in 1977. It is basically just a whole bunch of the Looney Tunes cartoons that had been originally played as shorts before feature films in cinemas, had been repackaged in the 60s as the Looney Tunes half-hour cartoon show. These are all things that I could have watched as a kid, but there was a sense of bigness and importance to these cartoons as they got bundled into the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie. There's other compilation films like that, but none of them ever really quite as big as that Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie. And so I kind of got thinking about two things. One is the canon that we establish for what are beloved properties. Peppa Pig means nothing to you and I, but for a generation of kids growing up, they will be referring back to this at some point throughout their lives. Okay, Peppa Pig will be a cultural aspect of Murphy's life for at least the next, you know, 30 or 40 years until we can no longer
like
live on this
planet. Like Oscar the Grouch is to me, like John Hamm is to you. I get it.
Yeah, the most handsome man in America. Sorry. No, I'm not going to say what I was going to say. That's just going to be too crude. John Hamm's very well endowed, as is Oscar the Grouch. Okay, so what I was going to sort of throw to here is just the idea of, do these movies establish pop cultural canon? When you think about the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie, and I've got two aspects to this, Simon, okay? Do you think about those animated shorts that existed in that feature film as being the core Looney Tunes cartoons when you think of Looney Tunes. And is it a result of this movie? And I think it is.
Yeah, no, not for me, but I get what you're saying.
What cartoons do you immediately think of when you think about Looney Tunes and Bugs Bunny?
Well, the Looney Tunes cartoons, for me, it was a big deal to go to see the Looney Tunes Roadrunner movie. And funnily enough, I saw it at the Hornsby Cinema, which has come up in our discussions in previous episodes of Screen Watching. I remember seeing it there. But it was the thrill of seeing episodes I was already very familiar with from afternoon television on the big screen. Yeah. That was the pull. So, yes, Robin Hood Daffy, the Wab at the Opera one, which was, and I do apologize. I used to know the names of all of these, but I don't know them now. But so there's the Dancing Frog, of course. So these were the episodes that I remember. Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, I couldn't actually tell you what were the cartoons that were in the movie.
Well, I'm pretty sure all of those shorts are in the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie. Okay. Also, Marvin Martian with the Where's the Kaboom? They're supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom. Pretty sure that's in there. But like, I kind of think that when we think about Looney Tunes cartoons, okay, a lot of what we think about when we're thinking about Looney Tunes is shaped by what's in that movie and probably less so by the show, which we probably watched a lot more. Like, we've logged more hours of our lives watching the half-hour compilation where they just play the shorts back-to-back for half an hour. Okay, like I'm sure we've seen that so many more times, but when we think about Looney Tunes, it's because of a compilation like that. And I just kind of thought that was a bit of an interesting element. But the other thing I just wanted to throw at you very briefly was, what is the first film you saw in the cinema?
It was Disney's Peter Pan at the North Ride Drive-In.
And do you remember? Oh, no. So
my early...
I always get stuck in this question whether a drive-in is the same as a cinema for a movie experience and whether watching something on home video is the same thing as a first movie. And yeah, I'm not sure that it is.
We've addressed this previously. What was your first one? I know you have a very early memory of E.T., don't you?
Simon, we addressed this on a podcast that didn't go out, hence why we're doing it again.
I mean, yes, I would say a drive-in is a movie-going experience. Matilda, which was a movie starring Elliot Gould about a boxing kangaroo, I remember seeing very early in my movie-going days. One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing with Robert Morley, one of the great Disney live-action, and I use the word great advisedly. So, yes, I do have a very vivid memory of going, but it was definitely the first time I sat and stared at a big screen was Peter Pan at the North Ride Drive-In. I distinctly remember that experience, and I would have been younger than 10.
Yeah, so look, I'm told that the first movie I saw was E.T. on the big screen, which apparently I went to as a two-year-old, maybe three-year-old, two-year-old, I'm going to say. I think it came out 82, so I would have been 2 years old. Apparently I cried a fair bit through it and it was deeply embarrassing to my uncle. This is family stories that get told. But like, I've got no recollection of that at all. Like, my first actual memories of going to the movies, I've sat down trying to work out, like, you know, of films that I remember seeing at the movies, and I can't work out one that's earlier than this, is seeing either Back to the Future Part 2 or Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Like, one of those two movies is my first cinema experience. Oh, sorry, or also maybe 1989 Batman.
Yes, you have mentioned that before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the podcast. First movie experiences.
Yeah. Okay. But also, as a kid, we used to drive in a lot. So I've seen a lot of films at the drive in, but I'm not sure I really count that.
Oh, you got to count that. It's a movie going experience. Yeah. You're watching movies.
I mean, I think it's a different experience. Also, can you really review a movie on Letterboxd if you haven't watched the full movie? Okay, like can you say that you saw a movie at the drive-in if you only saw the first 25 minutes and fell asleep on the back seat? Or there's the there's the other version of drive-in movies as well, which is, you know, one that we're not going to discuss here on the podcast, but it's too polite for such things.
Yeah, yeah, they were good times. I didn't see, there was a double feature of Some Kind of Wonderful and The Golden Child, which I saw maybe the first 10 minutes of The Golden Child, and then things kind of got a little steamy. Anyway, I've said too much.
Were you there with the second person?
Oh, no. God, no, no, no. I didn't have any friends at the time at all. All right, so that brings us to the end of the Peppa Pig, The Future of Cinema intermission. Boy, I'm really glad we put it where we put it, because it wouldn't have fitted in this other segment called What Else Have You Been Watching? Oh, my God, look how far into the podcast we are. Dan, what else have you been watching? No, in fact, I'm going to go first because I've got a very quick one to say here. Let's drop in some kind of sting. I have been watching through the week a little show called This Is Me Now. This is a concept video from one Jennifer Lopez, who I loved in Anaconda. This is a heavily CGI'd, woefully overproduced, garish collection of her latest songs that reminded me of, and it's a bit of a stretch, but Xanadu with our own Olivia Newton-John in terms of its bewildering array of bad decisions made creatively in the name of entertainment. We go on a journey that involves a understanding Jennifer Lopez and the trials and tribulations of the love life she has or hasn't had, and how she might have been addicted to love and addicted to romance, but that led her down to some toxic relationship paths. It is the most wildly self-indulgent piece of self-promotion I've seen really. She makes some, or the people she works with make some bad decisions in trying to work Ben Affleck into the hour-long travesty as well. We haven't forgotten that it was this sense of inflated ego and sense of entitlement that made us hate Ben and Jennifer in the first place, and why Gilly, a film that I've tried three times to watch and when I get to a certain point just can't watch any more of, why we hated that film so much. They seem to have not learnt anything, because this is such a look at me bit of self-promotion. That also feels very much of a different time when you've got Taylor Swift and Beyonce doing far more creative and far more spectacular and far more resonant bits of live footage and their own sort of sense of self-promotion than this. And this is the first time where I really haven't liked J-Lo in anything. It's just an awful hour-long bit of garbage. So anyway, it's called This Is Me Now, .. and it's on Amazon Prime if you have that streamer.
Had you watched the original, which is This Is Me?
Which, what was that? Was that a J-Lo thing?
Yeah.
No. Oh, maybe back in the day. I don't have any recollection of that, but.
It's a song or a music video. I'm not too sure. But anyway, I just don't know you could even understand what's going on in the sequel if you hadn't seen the original, frankly, Simon. Maybe this is on you.
Oh, yes, I know. It's such a dense narrative both of them offer. What have you been watching, Dan?
Look, so one of the shows that I think is quietly being dumped a little bit, when you see a big blockbuster HBO drama being dropped in March, with big names and big talent involved and no media appearances really anywhere around the place. And right before you start campaigning for Emmy nominations, I know you get a bit worried. I mean, that's pretty much where we're at. So it's a TV series called The Regime. This is Kate Winslet. And look, props on Kate Winslet and HBO for not just doing Mare of Easttown 2. Mirror of Easttown, or whatever you'd call it, I'm not too sure. But like, it's good they didn't just come back to the well and just, you know, try to recapture that magic. But what she's doing instead is something which is a very sort of tonally specific light drama, more leaning into comedy series. It's basically her starring as, and I was just looking it up to see if it was actually a name of a country. I don't think it is. She's the chancellor of an unnamed Central European nation. Yeah. And basically, she's a over the top figure that wants to be able to control everything, and obviously everything spirals out of her control, and you know, she can't really handle it. The laughs supposed to just keep on flowing with the the eccentricities of this woman as she's trying to measure the temperature in the room, and she's got like a body man that's always supposed to be measuring it and finding out what the humidity is, and so much time is dedicated to this, and it all seems to be setting up a joke in the same way that a skill tester involves skill. It seems to be setting up just the joke where she's at this dinner party in the first episode talking to the American dignitary sitting there and negotiating something, but then the body man like checks in and says, oh, the humidity's whatever. And she's like, you make me seem like a crazy, ridiculous person. It's like, well, because you are. And then that's supposed to be the joke, but it's not really. And this funny. Kind of thing, like this, in no way is it funny. Like, it's just so tired.
I am quite excited about this. I think this is a prestige program. I think this with Kate, with Hugh Grant, with Oscar nominee out of her own pocket, Andrea Riseborough, and from the team that put together some of the best bits of Succession, this has got kind of prestige written all over it. I haven't seen it. I'm gonna have a look over the weekend and before it launches all around the world on March 4 and offer up my opinion next week. But I think there's something to offer here.
No, it's an attempt at prestige that hasn't worked. So the writer of it, the showrunner of it, is Will Tracy. Will Tracy's the guy that his history is he was like a writer on Last Week Tonight for a bunch of years. Not the showrunner of that program by any means, but, you know, when you're on a writing team of something like that, you can just generally go off and get a bit more clout. He wrote on Succession for, I think, the first couple of seasons, if not the entire run. He was part of the writing team there. But the thing that I'm sure is probably what's led to him getting this HBO series was he's the guy that wrote The Menu, which was that really wonderful restaurant satire from a couple of years ago. Okay, and like it's a bleak, dark comedy satire. Okay, and you can tell that this is totally very similar to that. Like that's what they're going for. It just doesn't work. Like it's just the thing where people went into it best of noble intentions, but it's just so flat on screen. It just doesn't deliver, which is a shame because really good talent, like the pedigree is obviously there for it, but the show itself, it's just kind of nothing. And there's a reason it's being dumped out and, I'd advise don't bother watching this. If you want to see something a bit like this that actually does work, there's a really good, really underseen comedy from, I'm going to say maybe like 2013-ish, 2011, thereabouts, called Ambassadors or The Ambassadors, a three-part series starring the cast of Peep Show. Tom Holland is in there as well for at least one episode. It's a really smart, savvy thing where, again, I don't think it's an unnamed country, but it's like a Eastern European country from memory. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I do remember finding that to be incredibly funny and charming and sort of hit all the satirical notes of the idea of, taking bureaucratic power to task within sort of unnamed fictional these realms. That's worth a look. You can find that one probably still on Stan. It was there for ages. It's not hard to find. That's worth a look. The Regime, just give it a bit of a miss.
This Is Me Now is on Amazon Prime. The Regime is on Max or Showcase here in Australia, which brings us to the freshly named segment, This Week in History.
Sorry, Simon, we've got young hip people watching this. They don't subscribe to regular Foxtel and Showcase. They are watching it on Binge, the streamer.
Ah, nice. Okay, Binge is good too. This Week in History. All right, broadcast on NBC, Dan Barrett, the 70th Miss America pageant did what for the first time on this day, March 3, 1990? The 70th Miss American pageant, just reach over there behind you and grab the VHS copy of it that I know you have. What did it do for the first time on this day?
I'm not really too sure. What's even interesting about the Miss America pageant that could have changed? Like,
I can think of a few things.
Well, the things that would have changed. So, I mean, I'm thinking, I don't think they do a swimsuit competition anymore, but that wouldn't have been, that'd be more like a last like 5 or 10 years thing. That's not 1990. Obviously it would have been color, like stereo sound, which is important for a competition like that. Talent competitions have been running for, I've got no idea. What's unique?
Carol Gist, a 20-year-old from Wichita, Kansas, was the first African-American to be crowned Miss USA. It was also the broadcast that was the last time former host Burt Park sang, "There she is, Miss America," to the new winner. He'd hosted the show since its very early years, and it was the last time. Good on you, Bert, and good on you, Carol. Just wonder whatever happened to you. March 4, 1992, which folk pop great taped his all-acoustic episode of MTV Unplugged at the Kaufman Astoria Studios in Queens, New York? March 4, 1992.
I was about to take a complete stab at this, and I was just going to say, like, it's a Paul Simon or something, even though I couldn't remember him doing an MTV Unplugged. But there's something about the fact that it's 1992, and I'm thinking about other pop culture at the time. Could it be James Taylor?
Wow, that is an incredibly guess, considering you got it right the first time, but wrong the second time. It was Paul Simon. MTV launched MTV Unplugged in 1989. It won a Peabody Award and 3 Primetime Emmy nominations. It ran for 101 episodes, and Rolling Stone rated the 1993 appearance of Nirvana as the greatest Unplugged episode ever. I remember that. It was a great episode. March 7, 1988.
Simon, it's 2024. People only remember one episode of Unplugged, and it's that one.
What was it?
From Nirvana.
Yeah, loved Unplugged. Amazing. March 7, 1988. Now, here's one I've written especially for you. Underpants and Negligee Party premiered on this day, the first pay-per-view special by which controversial media figure. I'll read that again. Underpants and Negligee Party premiered on March 7, 1988, by which a pay-per-view special by which controversial media figure.
Now, look, Simon hasn't noticed, but a little while ago I did rebrand this podcast as Underpants and Negligee Party, which you can find on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you find good horny podcasts. Look, I'm looking at this. I'm thinking about the name of it, pay-per-view. You said controversial media figure. Question, was this media figure controversial in 1988?
Yes.
Or is it more that history has turned?
Well, he was kind of controversial for being just a loudmouth creep, really. And he's kind of rebranded himself as somewhat of a more serious commentator of late. Still around, still very popular. But back in 1988, he was making pay-per-view specials called Underpants and Negligees.
Okay, well, I was thinking it was Hugh Hefner, and it was like a Playboy thing, but you're saying still around, so I'm not sure. Who are we talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about one Howard Stern. It was one of his first gigs, and it was originally only broadcast on the East Coast, New York and Connecticut affiliates, but was syndicated nationally and became a very popular VHS release worldwide. God knows I had a couple of copies. Let's go to birthday quiz.
Sorry, just going back. The thing that was throwing me with it was I couldn't really work out who would call it like an underpants party, because it's such a silly, humorous term. But I thought, like 1988, like who else is doing it other than like a Hugh Hefner or some sort of other, softcore porn purveyor. But, Howard Stern hosting something like Underpants and Negligee Party, that makes all the sense in the world.
Birthdays.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
This week's birthday quiz, I think, is a walk-up start. I think it's very, very easy for you, Dan Bratt, being a man of some intelligence. March 2nd, 1917, Desi Arnaz, there he is in black and white, if you're looking at our Facebook page as we do this. March 3, 1970, the beautiful Julie Bowen. March 4, 1958, the also beautiful Patricia Heaton. And the March 7, 1956, beautiful, if you're into that kind of thing, Bryan Cranston. An eclectic bunch of birthday buddies this week. What could they all have in common? No clues. You should get this.
Well, look, I look at all these sitcom stars and I think to myself, the only thing they could possibly have in common is all having days at Tucker Carlson.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. They are all sitcom stars, but they've played a very specific role in their sitcoms. What might that be?
Oh, I mean, they were all parents in their sitcoms, but I think it's important to note that it is quite likely that Julie Bowen has in fact dated Tucker Carlson.
Has she really? Is that a real thing?
Apparently.
Wow, that's heavy. Yeah, they're all sitcom spouses was what I thought. But yes, parents will work as well. Desi Arnaz, of course, was married to Lucy in I Love Lucy. Julie Bowen, married to Ty Burrell in Modern Family. Patricia Heaton, married to Harry Romano in I Love Raymond. And what was the other thing she did, the middle with other guy who did that thing in the show? Yeah, I can't remember what it was.
The guy from Scrubs.
Wonderful. Mind right now. Yeah, beautiful. Wonderful actress and very talented. And Bryan Cranston was the husband and dad in Malcolm in the Middle. So there you go, this week's birthday quiz. Why do I feel like Patricia I've been on this Heaton. Podcast now for like 2 days? Yeah.
Patricia Heaton, I cannot stand. I think she is absolutely the worst person I've ever seen for the last 50 years. Oh, well, none. Well,
clearly, we can't be friends anymore. I think Carlson
is more watchable than Patricia Heaton.
Jeez. I love Patricia Heaton. The whole world loves Patricia Heaton. This is really cutting into your credibility as a man of television. Patricia Heaton's beloved, Dan Barrett, beloved.
I'm not sure that's true, but anyway, let's go on. Oh, wait, we're at the end.
Yeah, of course we're at the end. It's been going for like 4 hours.
Everybody loved Raymond, not everybody loved Deborah. Just keep that in mind.
You can find all things to do with screen watching at these following hashtags or ands or whatever you call them. On Facebook, we're at Screen Watching Podcast. We're on Threads and YouTube at Screen Watching. You can email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. That was all wrong. Dan, what do you do when you're not doing this podcast?
Oh, well, just generally walk the earth, dispense wisdom, foot rubs occasionally. But when I'm not doing all of that, you can find my newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching. You can find that at alwaysbewatching.com. It's a daily newsletter that has stories about the screen industry, mostly TV, a little bit of movies, and sometimes video games and virtual reality and other things you watch with your peepers. You can also find me on the various social media networks, primarily Threads and Blue Sky, and find me there at, I'm not even sure what the Blue Sky thing is anymore. It's like danbarrett.bsky.blue.underscore.ampersand.askjeeves.com.
All right, we'll put it in the show notes below for everybody. And you can find my work over on the Patricia Heaton Forum, where I'm the administrator, and I've just blocked Dan Barrett. Okay, thank you, Dan. Long podcast this week, but I think a very productive one. Those of you who want to rush out and see Peppa Pig Cinema Party, it's on at cinemas around town as we speak. I'm glad we went ahead with that. I thought it worked quite well.
I can't believe you went and saw it. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week. We're probably going to discuss some Hey Dougie, and then we're going to move into Beep and Mort.
Rugrats.
Well, they are making
a Nickelodeon rundown. Yeah, they are. Yeah. No, that'll be exciting.
Okay. So, anyway, you've been watching Nickelodeon Watching. We'll be back next week. Simon, calm down. I'm trying to sign off. Don't get me excited. This has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week with all the 7-minute kids' cartoons you can shake your fist at. We'll see you then.